In 2022, Team Milk came together by sponsoring female marathon runners for the marathon in New York City. Today, they're more than 20,000 strong. In 2024, Team Milk is making an even bigger commitment to female runners and launching the only women's marathon in the U.S. designed for and by women. The inaugural Every Woman's Marathon will take place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. You can learn more and register for the marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
I think we can all agree the current political moment is fraught. But how does it compare to the other fraught political moments in history?
It felt for a time in part of that decade like everything was falling apart. Young people against old people, anti-war violence, peace movement.
I'm former U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara. And this week, presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin joins me on my podcast, Stay Tuned with Preet. We talk about difficult times in America's history and how its people overcame them. The episode is out now. Search and follow Stay Tuned with Preet wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, before we get going, I just want to say that support for today's show comes from Google Play, where you can now download and listen to audiobooks. That's right. Thousands of titles a la carte. You don't need a subscription. They integrate across the whole Google ecosystem, so you can listen hands-free with Google Assistant or Chromecast. And the best part is, as a listener to this show, you'll get $10 off your first book over $10, first audiobook over $10, I should say, by visiting g.co/play/longform. Again, g.co/play/longform. Find your story with audiobooks on Google Play. Hello and welcome to the Long Form Podcast. I am Aaron Lammer. I'm here with Evan Ratliff and Max Linsky.
Hello, Aaron.
Hey.
Who's on the show this week?
We have John Caramonica, New York Times music critic.
Long time coming, man.
Long time coming. Well, ever since he gave Francis and the Lights my band a bad review in 2010, I've been waiting for my revenge. I got it here in the studio this week.
I'm so happy for you, man.
I actually really like his writing. He's probably the music critic that I've been reading consistently the longest. And he has an interesting job in an interesting time for music writing. I think I was remembered to ask him to come on because he had a big interview with Kanye West around the release of his record. And I was thinking back about interviews he had done with Kanye West before the release of previous Kanye West records. And I realized that I'm fairly old and also that I wanted to talk to him.
Yeah, I feel like you and Caramonica have aged together.
We're both, our facial hair is a similar silvery tint. We are brought to you, as usual, by MailChimp, who also are bringing you Read This Summer.
ReadThisSummer.com. Shea Serrano has curated a group of authors with all kinds of fantastic books. So if you're looking for something to read, go to readthissummer.com. And if you happen to be in the Atlanta metro area around Labor Day, go to the Decatur Book Festival.
Every time you bring up the Decatur Book Festival, it makes me sad that we don't get to go this year.
I tried, man. I really tried to get MailChimp to bring us back, and they were like, you're not allowed.
There's nothing stopping you guys from going as civilians to this book festival. It's a free country. Thank you to MailChimp. They make things like this show, like that book festival, possible, and we appreciate it.
And now here's Aaron with John Caramonica.
Welcome, John Caramonica. Arrived at the studio with definitely the best snack selection that anyone has ever brought.
First of all, you know we came through dripping.
Yes.
With the Fiji, the Dr. Pepper, and the high chew.
Yeah.
Eschere.
Yeah, yeah. So I think very few people have like such a neat framing device for their career, so I'm just going to do it. You tweeted that you had recently that you had done 4 Kanye interviews over 10 years.
And that's all I've ever done.
And
I'm
so
just, I've never done anything else.
If I was doing like your story as a writer in like the style of a cable movie, mm-hmm. I think we would like start at the first one and then go from there. So where was your life at when you wrote a story about Kanye, did an interview in 2007? I guess the news peg was the European Music Awards, I think.
No, that was, I think, that wasn't the news peg. I think that was, what was the album that year?
I think Graduation was about
to
come out.
Yeah, I think it was Graduation. So in 07...
For people who haven't listened to any Kanye West albums, you can go back and listen to them. It might be good grounding for this interview.
A rapper and producer and fashion designer.
And John is the music critic at the New York Times.
Yes, I'm a pop music critic in the New York Times. I write the Men Shopping column.
Host of the podcast.
I host the podcast. Like and subscribe. Okay, so 07. So I did have a career before Kanye West. It's true. So I've been at the Times a little more than 10 years. Just before that, I was at Vibe. I was the music editor of Vibe. Shouts to Danielle Smith. So while I was at Vibe, I was writing other stories. I wrote this piece about Ye, and I wrote it as a freelancer for the Times. This was before I was on staff or on contract. And for me at that moment, it was clear that Kanye was going to become the thing. It's tough to say the exact thing he became because it's morphed so many times over the years. But it was obvious that he was an incredible force. And I was really struck. I spent some time in the studio with him. And I was really struck by something that I don't think a lot of people talk about, which is how open he is, or certainly not then I'm talking about, how open he is to other people's ideas and influence and kind of opinion. And he was recording. I think it was Flashing Lights. And so he has some female vocalist in the booth. And she is doing different versions of the chorus vocal, and he's like, you know, sexy astronaut, sexier astronaut, you know, he's coming up with all these sort of like strange things, and then asking kind of whoever comes in the room, like, what do you think of that? Like, is that good? That good? I think like 90% sure someone delivered food, and like that person also got asked. And I've been in a lot of studios over the years, and that's just not really how people operate. People who are working in the studio tend to assume that they are the most knowledgeable person, that they're beyond reproach. And Kanye, I think it was very clear even at that moment that, not that he doesn't have that streak in him, but that his willingness to absorb was very high. And certainly over the years, that's been made manifest in a lot of other ways, some less appealing than others.
So I want to pause you there. Okay, so you said this is how generally, like, how a person delivering food gets treated in a studio. They're not usually asked about it.
Also how journalists get treated in a studio.
Well, that's what I want to ask you. So, like, you're sitting in the studio, and I assume you still do this.
Yes.
This is like, you've, like, logged your 10,000 hours in the studio without a single to your name.
That's true. I should get some credit.
It's actually, I think, unusual for reporters to be given access to that directly to the creative process. Mm-hmm. Like, film critics don't go to film sets, generally.
That's interesting. Yeah, that's a fair comparison, I think. But finish your question before.
So what is your role when you're there? What is your vibe when you are hanging out with someone while they are making their music?
You definitely want them to forget you're there. I think this is true across disciplines, across journalistic practice. You want to observe people in their truest environment. A thing that I have noted as a journalist in various studios over the years is the rhythm of a studio is kind of on its own. It's happening.
Yeah.
Oftentimes, like, I was in a studio, this couldn't have been 3 weeks ago, with Juice WRLD. I showed up. There's already 8 to 10 other people there.
Yep.
And then by the time I left, 30? So at a certain point, I'm not a problem. And that's good. I don't want to be a problem.
Oh, I hadn't thought about it. There's a lot of smokescreen in a studio, both
100%.
Literal and metaphorically.
Oh, 200%. But I've also been in studios where I'm only one of two or three people.
Yeah.
I think in those cases, the artist has an instinct to play towards you.
Mm.
I will try to do what I can to not be played towards.
Mm.
Sit on a couch on the far corner, you know, just put your recorder somewhere out of the way. Like, don't, if I want to observe something, you know, you don't want to be the person that changes the thing that gets observed. In a way, the chaotic studio is the optimal environment. It may not be the cleanest environment in the sense of I can get every single detail, but it is optimal because most people aren't thinking about me.
Does this inform you? So when you go into a studio with someone and you're watching them make art, and then later they release the art that you saw them making, and then perhaps 5 or 10 years down the line, they're making another record, and you're like, I remember in 2009 when I saw this person in the studio and they're behaving in this kind of a way. Like, does all of this stuff sort of build your knowledge of who they are? Are you not just writing a single profile, but sort of building up like a, like almost obituaries style database of things that are interesting to you about this person?
Yeah. I don't know if I thought about it in exactly that literal of a term, but I think especially for artists who have some kind of signature sonic innovation, aesthetic approach, whatever. Young Thug is a great example of this. You listen to Young Thug's tapes, and it's clear that he's playing with melody, he's elastic with words, he's sort of completely deconstructed the idea of what rapping is, like, as sort of a technical thing.
Yeah.
But it really helps that I spent one night in the studio with Young Thug watching him make a song.
Yep.
Not a famous song. I don't even know if the song ever came out, to be totally honest. But that was an example where there were maybe four or five people in the room, and I saw him basically talk about gambling for 2 hours and then disappear. And I was like, oh man, like, I'm just never, this is just not going anywhere. You know, yeah. Like, I have some good quotes about gambling, but I guess I, you know, not yeah. happening. And then all of a sudden I see the engineer starting to work and I'm trying to figure out what's happening. And I look in the booth and it's just totally dark. And I was like, man, this is fucking weird. Like, what's going on here? And I see the engineer kind of like mumbling conversation, like, and he's having a back and forth. And Thug is in the booth with, I guess, a bottle of alcohol and some weed or whatever. And he's fumbling his way to a melody, one line at a time. He's hearing the beat over and over again, and the engineer's capturing one snippet at a time, and Thug is building the melody of the song. And if I had never seen that, I maybe could have had some abstract appreciation for what Thug does, but especially as a guy that grew up in Brooklyn, grew up on New York rap, like, I'm used to, like, written bars. Like, that to me was the gold standard from when I was a child. To see that and to understand and appreciate that as its own kind of like aesthetic gift was really valuable. And it made me not think, I don't want to say it made me think differently about the quality of his music because I've always been really enamored of it, but I understood it much more as craft as opposed to just sort of like happenstance. Like, oh, he just like showed up and it just happened.
It seems like some of the elements of modern music, like the one you just described. I apologize if you're listening to this show and you've never heard any rap music.
Oh my god! Do y'all have listeners that haven't heard rap music? Come on!
If
man.
You don't recognize a term, it's probably a rapper. Young Thug raps.
God.
So
don't at me.
Don't at me, Mr. Harmonica. But it seems like when I think about music from the 60s, 70s, 80s...
I've never heard any of that music.
Up until even the golden era hip-hop that you're describing, a lot of these things are like things that you more or less can understand as a performance. And you're like, how did they make them? It's like, well, they went into a studio and performed that. He rapped his bars into a microphone. And then you have modern forms, and I think this... Kanye West is an example of this in terms of the collaboration team, people going to Hawaii idea, or even a Young Thug is an example of music that's basically being written in real time in a computer and pieced together like a collage. It seems like music is getting harder for people to understand like what it exactly is they're hearing and how it's been made.
Well, I mean, I guess if you are from the data generation.
Yes.
It maybe is not as difficult to comprehend. Although I will say, as someone myself who straddles these generations,
yes.
Sort of like raised in a maybe more classical mindset, but kind of still like comfortable.
You had an email in college, but not high school.
Exactly. My freshman year of college was the first year that every freshman was assigned an email address.
There you go.
That had not happened.
That's the fissure in the world.
It really is. So, you know, I balance these two kind of approaches. It probably took me a minute to... And get comfortable, but now I'm super comfortable. A really good example of this. Okay, so like I said, I've been at the Times a little more than 10 years. And probably in my third or fourth year, I began to realize that there were only so many ways we were writing about music. Like, we were reviewing concerts, we were reviewing albums, we'd like do an artist profile. But that there was so much happening outside of that, that we should really figure out a way to do more of that.
Give me an example, like what you mean outside of that.
So I wrote a profile of a guy named Kook Harrell. And Kook was a vocal coach or a vocal producer. And really what he did, and I didn't totally understand. I just knew I saw his name popping up on credits. This is why I miss credits. I miss metadata. I miss all that stuff.
Because I feel like they're coming back. Like the credits drop is now like a news
thing. Yeah. It's its own thing. Although often it happens like 2 weeks after.
And often it's completely wrong. But other than that, at least people are interested.
I can't tell you how many times I've emailed a publicist on the day an album is actually available and been like, can I have the credits? And they're like, we don't have those.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, that's cute. We don't have that. Anyway, but I would see Kook's name pop up in all these credits. And I was like, man, what is this guy doing? And I reached out to him and to his representatives. And they were like, well, do you want to come in the studio? And he could show you. I said, great. And I gleaned that he was Justin Bieber's vocal producer. And I was like, oh, well, wouldn't it be nice if we like went in the studio with Kook Harrell and Justin Bieber? And we made that happen. And I watched, and what he did is Justin had a demo that people had played for him. And he was like, I like that. I want to do that. And he basically went through it syllable by syllable with Kook and sang 10, 20, 30 different versions. And Kook, in the way that Young Thug was kind of like piecing out the melody, Kook was literally building in real time, you know, take 4, take 6, take 1, take 12, building the vocal in his Pro Tools or whatnot. And that was really instructive, because as much as I understood that pop music was like piecemeal and like that there were outside handlers doing massaging, there's thinking that, and then there's watching someone literally build a Justin Bieber song one syllable at a time with Justin Bieber in the other room trying 20 different versions of the bay, 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 bay. You know, that was really eye-opening. And so to me, not only does that make for a good profile of someone that a part of the pop music sphere that nobody knows, but also lets me understand how all the things that we hear on the radio are so kind of like the technology is kind of like it's an intermediary between us and the artist.
Yeah.
It's always there, especially now.
And it's the essential palette on which this art is being made.
In 2018.
Pro
absolutely.
Tools is the canvas.
Yeah. And I, you know, it's an instrument.
Yeah.
Much like a guitar.
Yeah.
Much like a drum machine. And, you know, I used to have occasional quarrels with the copy desk because I would say that someone used like an 808 drum machine and they'd be like, well, what's it? You know, you have to qualify. What's an 808? Like I would say an 808 and they'd be like, well, what's
TR
that?
TR-808?
Right. But at the same time, like I'd be like, well, if I said guitar, you wouldn't tell me to qualify what a guitar
right.
was. Like an 808, it may not be an instrument that
yep.
everyone is familiar with, but like it's still an instrument and
yep.
we're still going to call it what it's called.
Okay, I'm going to rewind even further now. So
yeah,
you said you grew up in Brooklyn.
I did. I grew up in Sheepshead Bay, which is outer Brooklyn, like
yep.
the southeast corner, and then in Mill Basin, which is sort of on the far east side, kind of like by the Queens border.
Tell me about growing up in Mill Basin and Sheepshead Bay.
Well, yeah, Sheepshead Bay. So basically my entire mother's side of the family all lived in the same building in Sheepshead Bay. The bay is an actual bay, runs along Emmons Avenue. And at the end of the bay, there's a one-block street called Shore Boulevard with buildings that overlook the end of the bay. And my grandmother and great-grandmother and their whole families lived in that building. So I spent a lot of my time there. Sheepshead Bay, if you haven't been, it's extremely far. It's just far.
Yeah.
And
especially from Manhattan.
Yeah. And like I kind of grew up, Manhattan was a real abstraction to me as a kid. As a young kid, my dad fixed cars. He owned a body shop in Manhattan, but that was kind of my only conceptual. It's like my dad goes there for work and he comes back. I didn't understand the city
yep.
as part of my upbringing. But by middle school, I went to a middle school in Bay Ridge, and then I went to high school in Manhattan. I went to Stuyvesant. So I became more fluent with the city and all the things that I'd sort of been soaking in kind of in passing, which is a, you know, hip hop, graffiti, like all these things that were slightly abstracted as a kid. Like for me, I grew up hearing all that stuff on the radio. And so to be in Manhattan where I was like, oh shit, this is like where it's all actually happening. Like it's like, it just felt much more in the air than in Sheepshead Bay and Mill Basin is like mafia territory at that time, very heavily Italian. It's right by the water. You know, it's a very isolated part of Brooklyn. There's no train station in Mill Basin. Like, you got to take a bus to get to the train. I grew up driving. Most kids who grew up in New York didn't grow up driving. I grew up driving because everywhere I ever lived was far away, and my dad fixed cars, so I always was around cars.
I'm also a longtime Brooklyn driver. I don't feel any need to defend it either.
I appreciate that. It's bizarre to me because I understand there's an energy of the city that you get when you're on mass trans, but like
a terrible energy.
Well, depends what hour, especially. But for me, like the energy of driving late night, windows open, music blasting, like that's my Brooklyn. That's my New York.
Did you have writerly ambitions as a teenager?
No, I didn't. I just sort of assumed. I didn't know anyone who was a writer, you know? Like, I think what I assumed at that time was I'd have basically a square job, you know, like a teacher or a lawyer or whatever. I'd get a square job. I'd just be like a lawyer who really cared about hip hop.
Yeah.
You know, like a teacher who was really into hip hop, an economist who really cared about hip. You know, there was no framework for me of like, oh, I can be passionate about this thing, find a way to be creative about it, become part of it in some way, and then actually like live. That was not a thing. Even when I would read like the earliest issues of The Source that I found, like I would read those things and I was like, oh, so nice. They just all like get together and make a Mac. Like it never occurred to me there were jobs. Like it never occurred to me anybody had like a 401k or anything.
Yeah.
Like I just was like, oh, it's just like a bunch of friends. They're just like making a magazine.
Yeah.
So that wasn't even, that was nowhere near the front or even the back of my mind. Yeah. I didn't know.
I'm trying to like locate in time. What era did the explosion of hip hop magazines occur? There was The Source, and then
Double XL.
Go to like a train station newsstand, mm-hmm. and there would be like really like knockoffy. An explosion.
You're
of
probably
them.
Thinking of the late 90s.
Late 90s.
So basically,
yeah.
The Source starts in the, I don't know if it's technically 89 or 90, but certainly by like 91, it's up and running for real. By the early to mid 90s, you had Rap Pages, Rap Sheet, 4080, places like that. But a lot of those were slightly regional. Like you were getting them more on the West Coast than you would get here. Vibe, obviously, from 92 or early 93 onwards exists as like the slightly more cosmopolitan alternative. Double XL launches in 97. My first like genuine like rap magazine piece was in the second issue of Double XL. So this is like late 1997. And then the thing that you're talking about where you go to the newsstands and it's like 100 magazines, I think that all kind of comes in its wake. Because it's number one, hip hop is fully pop music at that point. It's like on the charts. And there's demonstrated ad, the people are out there buying ads. And as you know, magazines only exist because people buy ads in them.
Or don't exist because people don't buy ads.
RIP, pour out a little Fiji for all the RIP dead magazines.
So how do you go from being a Brooklyn teen to getting a story in the second XXL?
Oh, man. So two steps. One, I met in the mid-90s a friend of mine named Oliver Wang, who was running at that time the 12-inch singles review column page in Herb magazine. Herb was a Los Angeles-based magazine that covered hip-hop and sort of like associated dance music genres.
Yeah.
So shouts to Oliver. Oliver, I met Oliver through this kid, Ed. Ed, who ran a website that still exists called Sandbox Automatic, which was like an indie rap retail website, who I went to summer nerd camp with, like in 8th grade or 9th grade, and just randomly like kept in touch with. So I wrote some single reviews for Oliver, and at school, at college, so I went to Harvard, I wrote a rap singles review column for the school paper. It was called 12 Inches.
And was it Jonathan Schecter who started The Source also
Schecter,
in Harvard?
Yeah.
So there was a rap journalism tradition coming out of Harvard.
So at college, I wrote the 12-inch singles review column. I DJed on the radio station. I had like a two-hour radio show every Saturday night for most of my time at college. And during senior year, myself and a few friends threw a conference, like a hip-hop conference. It was like a thing you could do at a college in the mid-90s and get like sort of notable people, like reasonably notable. But one of the people that I was in charge of getting was this guy, Reggie Dennis. Reggie had been the first like notable music editor of The Source in the mid-90s and had just left to found Double XL. And so he and I got to talking, and after I graduated, I stayed in touch with him. I sent him some of my writing. And at that time, I was like, I want to write about backpack rap. Like, I want to write about indie rap. And he was like, yeah, you'll get over that, but whatever. And so for issue two, he was like, okay, Stretch Armstrong put out this record. Like, you can write about that. And I was like, what? A dollar a word? Are you kidding me? I thought it was just like going to be like Honey and Roses from that point forward.
What was it like covering rap during that period?
It was a lot different than now.
Yeah.
It was a lot different than now. What's happening now is there's a presumption that everything should be covered. You know, everything is always documented, whether it's individual social media or certain kind of websites or that are dedicated to like underground music or whatever. Like everything is constantly covered. Back then, you had to fight to cover stuff. You had to fight to convince people that they should be covered.
Yeah.
It was strange. Like, you'd be like, I want to put you in double XL. And they'd be like, ah, okay. You know, like, it wasn't always, like, I remember I tried to chase, when Gucci Mane put out Icy, I literally spent a week working the phones trying to get a number for him. I mean, this is not that long. This is 15 years ago, 16 years ago. I just couldn't find him. And at a certain point, I just gave up, and then eventually someone else did find him. But it just wasn't as seamless as it is today. You know, everything was a lot looser. The rules were a lot... It was just wilder shit happening.
You were allowed to hit the blunt in the studio then?
I don't, you know, we don't, you know, no blunt. Just high chews and Dr. Pepper, man.
So, okay, I want to talk about what the difference is when you are going to them or they're coming to you. Because it seems like there's a real difference in the push-pull there. If you are seeking people out and saying, hey, I want to cover you, I want to do this stuff, that seems like a different equation than, it's a little more set out now, or the expectations are a little clearer.
It's been systematized.
Systematized.
Yeah,
yes.
And that's, I miss when it wasn't systematized. Although I do think in a perverse way, the kind of free-for-all that's happening on the internet right now, it actually creates an opportunity to de-systematize things. Now, people get absorbed into the system pretty quickly, like people who are hitting on SoundCloud, like all of a sudden are on Interscope or Atlantic or Def Jam, like that happens pretty fast. But like when I did, so like I did one of the first really big SoundCloud rap features. We're talking like this last April, last March.
Yeah.
None of those people had publicists. Like that was all just me kind of like, well, I guess Lil Peep at the time had a manager maybe. But like for the most part, that was just like a rogue renegade thing that was happening. And I just went out and kind of like put hooks in wherever I could put hooks in. So the internet kind of creates opportunities for that. But it also means that if you're doing well, you probably already have a booking agent. You probably already have a publicist. You probably low-key have a label, even if people don't know you have a label. That's frustrating to me because I like working in a less regulated environment. So there are parts of working today that remind me of the 90s, but I do think that it's people move from the kind of unregulated space to the regulated spaces far more quickly than they ever did back then.
What can you do with a artist who's in an unregulated space and does not have a publicist that makes it superior?
You don't want to say superior because I do think they're different.
Yeah.
What I do think is I like to interview people personally very early in their careers or very late in their careers. I think vulnerability and willingness to be vulnerable is at a peak in those two parts.
Yep.
You know, young enough not to know better, old enough not to give a damn. You know, I love Drake.
Yeah.
But like interviewing Drake on like his fourth album.
He's not going to say some crazy shit.
It's not. I mean, he may, but it's not as interesting to me because to me, the story that I want to tell is sort of like what you were asking in the beginning. Yeah. Like, how were you this person?
Yeah.
And then you became this.
Yeah.
And then at the end, let's look back on all these things and like, let's paint the arc together. But in the middle, when your primary obsession is how do I protect my role? How do I keep my role safe? How do I keep my spot? How do I keep the throne? I'm not as interested in that personally as a journalist or as a critic. So when you're interviewing someone who is basically pre-publicist, like sort of in the earliest phases, I like to think you're getting a pretty unregulated look into their lives. But also the downside of that is they maybe don't know what the best interview approach is. Like they may not know that me asking, oh, let me ask you about your hometown, your child, like they may see that as invasion rather than sort of normal journalistic practice. So like I've had issues where you interview someone and it can get a little bit testy because they're not necessarily used to being asked questions because they're that early in their career. And so you end up navigating a lot of different things than you would with someone who's like signed to Def Jam and like just has been media trained.
This is something I've noticed in long form also is that the profiles of people that endure are the profile, the person when they're really young on the cusp of fame and the person when they're really old.
Yeah.
And you're like, so the Times had a great profile of Dick Cavett.
Recently.
Very much along those lines, along the like, wow, Dick Cavett.
I hope to be around long enough to do like late life profiles with the people who I also did early life profiles with.
You did a thing about the sort of generation gap with rappers recently, right? Mm-hmm. And we all know where that story's going. It's going straight to the retirement. I mean, eventually
there will
be enough generations that you will be writing the Dick Cavett piece about Jay-Z.
I can't wait.
And you're planning to hang around long enough for this.
I mean, I bet until they kick me out, yeah.
Let's talk about the young one, because rap has not been around long enough for you to write the Dick Cavett style pieces.
Yeah.
So I'll take Juice WRLD as an example, just because I think it's like the last, the most recent piece you've written about a new artist, someone who's got like a surging single, but whose name I did not know 8 weeks ago.
Okay.
When you're coming in cold like that and you got a new audience, new artist, like how do you filter all of the noise about them into something that you can fit into a New York Times profile? And are you assuming, like in a New York Times context, are you assuming someone's heard Juice WRLD when you're writing about it?
No. It's okay. So this is something, and I wonder if you've spoken to other people who work at the Times, and I wonder if you've had similar conversations with them. There is, my audience is not a New York Times audience. Yeah. And that's not to say that I don't write for the New York Times and people who read the New York Times don't read me. But I firmly believe that, like, people who read me may not be the same people who read Rukmini, or who may not be the same people who read, like, Binya Applebaum.
Right.
Or whatever.
Right.
Like,
and Leslie Morris had a similar thing, which is, like, I write for the Leslie Morris audience.
Yeah. And that's how I feel. Like, I think there are people who come to me because they trust my aesthetic judgment and because they know that I'm delivering sort of a consistent, like if you look back over the last 10 years, like hopefully the story of pop music can be told through the stories that I've wrote over those 10 years. That's how I would like it to be. I think writing in that kind of like very insidery way, like if you go back and read some of my like Village Voice reviews from like the mid 2000s or the early 2000s, like it's super interwoven, hyper referential, like it's just, I can't even read him anymore. Like, I don't even know what the fuck I was talking about. But I think that's something that when I was writing for The Voice in its own way, or writing for XXL in that way, or The Source back in the day in those ways, you can make presumptions of your audience and say, oh, well, they're already this far along.
Yeah.
I don't think I do that anymore. And I think some of that is a conscious process. And some of that is I've just been writing for The Times for 10 years. So certain things become normalized.
Yeah.
But I like to think that I'm writing in a way that if you've never heard the person, you're not going to feel left out. You're not going to read the first three paragraphs and be like, I have no idea what's going on here. Also, these people to me, especially when I'm profiling them, like criticism and profile are different. Like my job is I'm a critic, but I do a fair amount of profiles.
Yeah.
Profiling is its own art. Like a great opening scene to a profile or a great opening set to a profile, like that should draw you in. That should draw you in if you have no idea. If it's about an actor, if it's about a theater director, if it's about a politician, like it should draw you in. And hopefully that skill gets brought to bear and people stick around and learn something about the music. But I don't ever want a reader to be like, wow, I couldn't possibly understand. It's ridiculous. And, you know, like, I've been out and, like, I'll meet people and they'll say, oh, you totally put me on to such and such. And they're in their 50s or their 60s or their 70s. I mean, that's all happened. That's because I write for the Times. If I was writing the same exact pieces for Complex or XXL or whatever, I don't think those people would find me. But I think it's great that they're able to find me because of where I write and don't feel alienated because of how I'm presenting.
And it seems like, and correct me if I'm wrong, that there's an excitement there for the artists themselves as well. Like, that we're living in a pretty anti-media time. Mm-hmm. And I've certainly heard, you know, musicians, artists of all stripes say,
it's not worth it for me to do media anymore. I only want to be able to do things where I can control my own messaging. I don't need them, blah, blah, blah. And it seems like
I only want to choose my own photographer.
And it
am
seems,
I choosing my photographer for this?
It seems like the Times is a big enough platform that it's exciting even to the cynical. And, you know, in the case of, let's say, the most recent Kanye West album, it seems like you got the most time with him.
I mean, I got the only time.
You got the only time. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's partially because of the Times and partially because of previous relationships. I mean, with that story in particular, like, I got like these weird emails where people be like, oh, was that pitched to you? Like, you know, like, did like,
oh, yeah, you got played.
I don't know. Or just like, you know, was that who set that up? And it's so funny because people genuinely have no idea how anything happens.
Yeah.
And to be fair, I like to keep some of the mystery because I'm not out here to like, I'm not trying to show like a play by play of like how my career happens. But the Kanye is a good example of, you know, that Wyoming event everybody flew out for. And in my mind, I was like, oh, I don't think he's going to talk to anybody, but like, I should try.
Yeah.
And without putting too fine a point on it, I shot my shot.
Tell me what it means that you should try. Like, what? How do you try in a situation?
Well,
like
I think, and part of the reason I'm able to try is because I have pre-existing relationships and I can probably get closer to where you can shoot the shot from than just someone who randomly flew out there.
Yeah.
But what that means for me is like making it clear that while I am here, a thing that I would like to achieve is not the thing that everybody else is here to achieve.
Right.
And I understand that everybody is here under those pretenses. And ostensibly, I'm here under those pretenses.
Right.
But everyone who I know should know that I have different intentions. And so I made that plain. Like once I arrived in Wyoming, I made that plain. I made that plain to representatives. And I talked to Ye and I said, hey, I'm here. Let me know.
Yeah.
And we pieced it together.
And there was probably six other people there from different publications who also were trying to shoot their shot, maybe. I would think.
As Mariah said, I don't know them.
So when you get the nod in a situation like that, like what is the nod and what are the terms of the nod? Like for that
There were
piece,
no terms.
No terms.
No terms. No terms at all. You know, as in any situation, if the artist says, hey, I want to tell you something off the record.
Right.
I respect the off the record.
Yeah.
But no terms.
Yeah, I mean, but like, could you get like how many hours?
Oh, I spent. I mean, the event was on a Thursday night because that was the album release night. I spent probably 8 to 10 hours with him on Friday and probably 6 to 7 hours with him on Saturday. And again, no, in my mind, I could get kicked out at any time.
Yeah.
There was no prearrangement. There was no like, you have exactly 90 minutes. Like, it was nothing like that. It was just like, come, hang out, see what happens. And I just did that, and I basically waited to get kicked out. Which is, like, I think not how Hollywood stuff happens. And I think it happened because it was Wyoming, and it's, like, wide open spaces, and, like, everybody's kind of feeling good, and Kanye wants to go see Yellowstone, so, like, we're just going to go see Yellowstone. But basically, I knew that at any moment I could just get kicked out.
And you could have gone to Wyoming and not gotten 0 minutes, and then that would have just been a different
piece. I was
totally
prepared.
And did you have, like,
I'd already written that piece, because I wrote the piece immediately Thursday night.
Like, you went about back, the bonfire.
About the event. Yeah. I came home, I stayed up till 5-6 in the morning. I wrote the kind of, like, scene piece.
Yeah.
No quotes, just like, here's what happened. Here's what the record kind of sounds like. Here's this weird thing that happened. We had a photographer there. Here's some cool pictures. In my mind, if I had not written another word from that trip, it would have still been a fine trip. Like, it would have been good. But I had a vision. And so I just tried to manifest that motherfucker, and it worked.
So for aspiring journalists listening,
manifest, Dom.
What does manifesting look like? What do you think has allowed you to get in rooms that maybe other people didn't get into or you weren't even sure that you were going to get into?
Yeah, I think about this a lot. I think it's a couple things. In my career, not just at the Times, but also prior to the Times, like I said, I really like to capture people early in their career. And I think when you capture someone early in their career in a way that they relate to, and you look them in the eye, and you make it clear that you understand the art that they're making, that you appreciate it, that you understand where it comes from, that you understand the big picture of it, that sticks with people. So that the next time they see you or think about you, they're like, oh yeah, that guy gets it. That guy's okay. I'm okay with that guy. And I think I've done a lot of that in various outlets over the years. I find especially younger artists really want to be understood. I think more famous people they want to control the narrative a little bit more. Like, they're not as interested in kind of a back and forth. But I feel like I can identify moments in early interviews with people who are now extremely famous, you know, like a Drake or a Taylor or whatever, where you can kind of see like, oh, we're having a real conversation about what they do. And maybe the 10 other interviews they did on that press cycle, maybe they didn't have a real conversation. I think that's helped a lot. And when it comes to later in career, if they want to open up or they feel like they want to share, that maybe puts me one step ahead of the next person. But to be honest, like, I haven't had a Drake interview in a while. I mean, that may change, but like, for whatever reason, he's, you know, I don't actually know if I even asked on the most recent. I didn't ask on the most recent.
Yeah, so like, do you like ask for everything or certain things? You're just like, fuck it, I'm not going to
ask. No, I didn't. Like with Drake, I didn't, because I just felt like, again, partially where he is in his career.
Yeah.
And also like, I don't know. It just didn't. Sometimes you can smell from a distance what the kind of like, how the relationship with press is at the moment. And I just sort of could smell that it wasn't there. Maybe next time. But there's no guarantee. This is the thing, is that there's no guarantees. But I think if I've been able to have longevity, it's because I haven't hitched myself or stuck myself to like one generation of artists where it's, yep, like it's either this generation or nothing. Like, you know, I can write about Juice WRLD and also write about Kanye and also like write about the Rem LZ art show. It's all of those things. So if for whatever reason one thing is not happening, there's 100 other things going on. Like, anyone who tells me they can't find good stories is not looking hard enough.
Do you find like any sense of creeping grumpy old man in yourself as a listener or anything like that? Like, how has your relationship with music changed in the last 10 years since you've been at the Times?
Yeah. There's two parts to that answer. One is the thing that makes me really grumpy are actual grumps. Like, way more than the music changing.
Yeah.
Like, people who are grumpy about it piss me off. Because it just, I know what it was like to be 14, 18, 20, and have old people tell me the music that I liked wasn't shit. How would I ever think that growing into an old man who then tells the me of 20 years later, the music you like isn't shit? What the fuck, man?
Yep.
What a horrifying idea. To me, one of the reasons I like being where I'm at, in the place where I write and also the music that I cover, is it's constantly changing. It keeps me on my toes. Like, it forces me to pay attention. And maybe, I mean, you know, I'm not married. I don't have kids. Like, maybe I see you in here with a baby today.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe if I'm running around with a baby someday, I won't be on the SoundCloud top 50. You know, like, that might happen. Do I move maybe like 5 to 10% slower than I did 5 to 10 years ago? Yeah, maybe. Yep. But I've also got other things to do. I write about shopping. I'm, you know, there's outside projects I'm
podcasting.
Like, oh my God, podcast, like and motherfucking subscribe.
Okay, so not a grump. I'm also, I think I've like alluded being a grump. And part of the reason that I think it's easier to not be a grump now is that I feel increasingly capable of finding music interesting that it exists without like totally liking it. Like, for instance, like the emo rap. Like, I didn't like emo the first time around. So unlikely I'm going to like love some of the emo strands of rap.
Sad white 30-year-olds around the country are turning. They're pressing pause. They're turning this podcast off.
But right, the interesting thing is it's still fascinating to me. It's still fascinating to me that kids who were super into Marilyn Manson are making rap music now.
And,
or that people who like Panic at the Disco and Blink 182 are major cultural touchstones for. So it still holds my interest without me like repping it per se.
Yeah, but what's interesting for me is I'd be lying if I said I had no comfort music. You know, like, do I listen to Cameron Purple Haze like for comfort? Yeah, of course. Like, but like, you know, there, the music that was formative or germinal for me, like, obviously it accesses a pleasure center that maybe something I just heard yesterday for the first time can't access, because your pleasure centers kind of get fixed at a certain point in your life. But just by pure percentage of all the music I listen to, 95% of it is new. Like, I'm not one of these people that's like, I listen to new music for my job, but when I get home, you know, I listen to Waylon Jennings. Like, it's not like that.
Yeah.
Like, I genuinely am curious and interested in what's happening right this second. I want to know the narrative of pop music that's happening right now. And to be honest, I was like this before I had this job.
Yeah.
It just so happens I lucked into getting a job that requires this of me. But it's how I've always been.
I've asked this of TV critics. I don't think I've asked a music critic yet. Do you have like a regimen? Are you like 2 hours in the morning, like hit the SoundCloud top 50?
Oh God, I wish.
Like,
I wish, is it
organized at all?
No, no. I'm an extremely disorganized person. It's very catch as catch can. We do a thing. We do like a Friday playlist at the paper. So like once a week, I'm kind of forced to SoundCloud top 50, YouTube new music, Spotify new music. Like I try to engage with those things. But it's very haphazard because for me, no 2 weeks are alike. Like the only steady things in my week are I record a podcast and I write this playlist. But everything else, like I could be traveling, I could be writing a profile. When I did the Kanye thing, like I was basically off grid for 3 weeks. Yep. Like if you look at my social media or you look at my byline page at the Times, there was just 3 weeks where I didn't write anything. And like the reason I didn't write anything because I was like I transcribed myself, but I was transcribing like 10 or 12 hours of audio.
Is that because you didn't want to like send it off to the
transcription? First of all, I would never send an important tape out to be transcribed. Second of all, you know, you go on and off record with people. I don't trust other people with that. And third, when you transcribe your own tape, you remember the nuances. You remember the context. You remember when the bag crunch happens, that's the Doritos. Like, you remember that.
Yeah.
And so I want to trigger all that for myself. So between transcribing, first draft, second draft, like, I just was off grid. So no regimen. I wish.
Someday with the regimen.
If someone has a good regimen, I would love to know what it would be. But, like, I can't imagine it would work.
So I think we've been talking more about the profile side than the criticism side.
Yeah. And I'm a critic, which is, you know, I'm a critic.
So thinking about the critic side, and this also applies to the profile side, because I think that the line is blurring a little bit when we, it's hard to not like bring biographical information into a critical review. Like if you're reviewing Drake, you can't be like, Drake, the music, not the person. Like,
no, and also like, I choose to do the profiles I choose to do because of a critical impulse.
Right.
Like, it's not like we're like, well, someone's got a profile, Chris Carrabba.
Yeah.
Like, I guess I'll just do it. Like, it's more like, I think this might be an interesting thing in the larger critical narrative I'm trying to tell. But maybe I can tell this story a little bit more effectively through an interview as opposed to through an essay.
So in the critical realm, like taking, I'm sorry that this interview has had the word Drake in it like 900 times. I don't know why I keep using.
Honestly, not enough.
Yeah.
More Drake.
So, okay. So you talked about people who are in between the like obituary story and the first story. And Drake fits squarely in that camp.
Yeah.
Still number one streaming artist in the world. Mm-hmm. Still really on the throne on some level.
Very much so.
But also, you didn't interview him for his last album. Didn't necessarily feel like you had to.
Mm-hmm.
When someone like Drake, there is so much noise coming out of the internet. There are so many takes.
It's a mess.
There are so many Instagram posts.
Oh, I'm so glad we're talking about this.
That I wonder, I listened to your podcast about the new Drake album, Scorpion, just because there's a million narratives converging on the Drake album, Scorpion. And not only can you not expect that your audience is aware of all of those narratives, lots of those narratives are kind of bullshit, but they're still kind of fun to talk about. Is the podcast like a vessel for you to be able to bring all of that stuff in? Like, I guess I think that when I imagine what the funnest conversation about music that's happening right now, it's probably like a bunch of music writers just talking shit and kind of having fun with it, more than like a, it's not like a Lester Bangs like seminal essay. We're not like really living in that time as much,
although I think as recently as like 5 years ago, maybe we were, but I don't think we are anymore. And that's, you know, if I'm having like any like crisis of career, it's trying to identify what the role of the critic is in like a very crowded internet. So like to your point, I'll answer the podcast thing first and then I'll go on this. Podcast is like an accident for me. Like podcast used to be Ben Ratliff's baby. Hi, Ben. I love you. I miss you. And I was sort of like co-host slash like play-by-play color commentary, you know, like
DJ Academics to his Joe Budden.
Sort of. Yeah. I mean, and I liked it because Ben was
pre-beef.
Ben is a very like serious and sober person.
Yeah.
And I would just come in and be like, rah! Yeah. And like, it just, it seemed funny to me. And I think we played off each other really well. We're good friends. And I think we liked the rhythm.
Yep.
We used to do like a yoga stretch before we would actually record. It was pretty funny. And then Ben left. Ben took the buyout to go write books and to teach. And it was, so the podcast was just mine. And I had to kind of figure out what it was. And what I realized what I wanted to do was not so much talk about things I couldn't talk about in my reviews, because I could talk about those things. I very rarely feel like I can't touch on a subject or a sub-subject in a review. But I was like, I want to talk to my friends. Like, I want to talk to the smartest people on a subject. And so sometimes there are people I know. Sometimes there are people I cold call or cold email and say, hey, you don't know me, but I'm an admirer of your writing, and would you like to come on and talk? And that's been a really like generative experience for me. Like, I've really enjoyed it, and I feel like rhythmically it doesn't sound like a lot of other podcasts, and I like the looseness, and I think we have incredibly dedicated fans, and I'm really grateful for that. So it's like a compliment, but not a replacement for criticism.
Yeah.
The thing that I worry about, so like Scorpion, let's take the Scorpion example. And this is something I've talked through with a couple people already privately. So if you are one of those people, I apologize. You can skip the next 60 seconds. So Scorpion comes out, you know, Thursday midnight into Friday morning. By that point, you already have 100, 200, 300 pieces of Drake content that's like anticipating what might be on Scorpion or who it might be about. Blah, blah, blah. Then Friday comes along, you've got pieces that are like single listener reviews, and then you have track pieces, and you have Drake producer Tay Keith speaks on working. You have all these like micro cutting up of the pie, and that's fine. I'm there for all of it. That said, that's another 300, 400, 500 pieces about Scorpion.
Yep.
Before I've even listened to it four times.
Right. And all of those pieces will never receive traffic within 2 days of right now.
Exactly. My goal, obviously, is to write as close to a definitive review as possible,
yep,
minimum a meaningful review. But there is so much signal chatter,
yep,
by the time my piece drops. Now, maybe I'm not doing my job well. Like, who knows? Maybe a perfect take should be able to, like, cut through all of that. But I think in this internet climate, it's really harder for any individual take, no matter how good it is, no matter how strong it is. It's hard for any individual piece to stand out and really shape the narrative. Whereas I do think as recently as 5 years ago, you can write a take and people would be like, that, I get that. I'm into it. I'm responding to it. It's like part of the discourse.
Yeah.
I think that's harder now. This also just, this was like a slightly tougher Drake era, because I do think what I'm waiting for with Drake is like the next aesthetic shift.
Right.
And I think Drake is kind of at the tail end of an aesthetic period.
Yeah.
So I think part of it is that Scorpion didn't naturally lend itself to like the oh shit take.
Right.
But I worry as a critic, and I think other critics I've spoken to are also worried, that criticism kind of as a practice is, there's a lot of clutter.
Yeah.
It's harder and harder to distinguish, especially online, between what is criticism and what's a take.
Yeah.
And what's a take and what's informational. And all those things really are muddied. And so I don't know what the practice of criticism is going to look like 5 or 10 years from now.
And some of those things that you're talking about aren't really takes in the classical sense of the word on the album. We know that they're not, because they come out before the album comes out.
They're pre-takes.
They're pre-narratives, really. They're like saying, Drake is this, this person is this, this is what this project means, these are the clues, right, these are all these things. So are you in more of a like a decoder role also now, where you have to? Because I feel like in some of these pieces, you're like, this is what people have been saying about Drake on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
It's important because this album is Drake rapping about what people have said about him on the internet.
Yeah.
Like, there's a self-aware,
yes,
meta element.
I mean, certainly for an artist like Drake,
yep,
who kind of makes metacriticism part of his own thing, that you have to do that.
Yeah.
And especially in a moment like this where he is not in his, like, you can mark two or three significant aesthetic shifts in Drake's career. We are not necessarily at a fourth point right now.
Yep.
So what you end up writing about are these kind of sub-narratives and kind of interwoven things. But also, all reviews don't serve the same function. a lot of times, if I think someone is doing an interesting thing that many other people are not doing, I will write something that's like incredibly musically driven, like a classic music album review or live concert review or whatever. That's like very old school. But a lot of times what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to create narratives. So like last week or 2 weeks ago, the YG album came out and I was like, this is a good album. It's like a slightly weird YG record. We have a pop music page on Thursday. We have to fill that page. I'll review the YG record. But also, like, I don't know if I have 1,000 words in me on the YG record necessarily. Oh, but the Buddy record just came out and Buddy does a different thing. Yep. And he's also from Los Angeles. And let's maybe try to tell a slightly more expansive story about this particular moment in hip hop in Los Angeles. So a lot of what I'm doing right now, especially because there's so much music, like it's impossible to review every important record or every important song or whatever. So there's so much music that a lot of what I'm trying to do is pluck things and be like, oh, you want a story about what's happening in 2018? It's this and this and this. Tie those things together and try to tell that story.
Compared to when you started doing this, when you could say, okay, what's like New York rap? It's like Dipset, it's this, it's this. It's like, maybe you can't list everyone, but like, it's like it's a smaller world. And now when you have like SoundCloud, you have these different platforms, different things. It seems like there's like more narratives converging than you possibly can cover all of them. Mm-hmm. Like when you start sort of summing it all up and painting the picture, what kind of larger stories are you trying to tell? Like if I, when you take a year of your columns, profiles mm-hmm. and criticism pieces all together, like, what is the broader narrative that you're trying to tap into?
I think for me, it's innovation. Mm. It's aesthetic change. A joke that I have said, a sort of uncharitable joke that I have made over the years, is like, I don't like reviewing like indie rock bands on their fifth album. Cause like, it's probably pretty much like the fourth album. It's probably, you know, like no shots to some indie rock bands that I'm sure I like and have innovate. But like, I want to go where the action is. Like, I want to go where people are saying the old way. Nah, fuck that.
Yeah.
Like, I'm doing some different thing. That to me is where I want to be. And so I would hope if you take any given year of my criticism, you will see not just a story of pop music in that year, cross genre, but you will also see the story of the people who are disrupting and making changes and causing problems and giving people anxiety. Those are the people I want to write about. That's not saying every single story I do has to be that, but I would hope that 80% of what I write about falls somewhere in that category. To me, that's the only meaningful way to do my job. I don't want to be in a position of just telling refried narratives. Why would I tell you, hey, this thing that was popular 3 years ago, still popular, still kind of sounds the same. I would much rather tell you about the weird kid who maybe is never going to be a superstar, but is sort of like agitating at the fringe. That's a story to me. I'll much rather spend a week of my life thinking about that than a week of my time sort of like onerously like retelling a story that's already been told 10 times.
It used to be that when you would look back on the past musically, you could use like, I guess the charts, you know, and say, okay, this is what was big. Here's something ascending. And the charts are a lot less clear what they mean now. I mean, they were probably kind of wonky to begin with, but
yeah, I mean, like, let's, you know, I'm always skeptical of false golden age.
Yeah, no. And in some ways I don't even think of that as a golden age. That seems like a very thin way to look backwards. But now, with the streaming age and really the biggest story in music in the last decade being Spotify itself or Spotify and its ilk.
Yeah.
Spotify does not have quasi transparent metrics in the way that Billboard does. They're cutting weird exclusive deals with people. Mm-hmm. I was reading something about the Tidal streaming numbers for The Life of Pablo look suspicious from a little data manipulation. How does that affect what you're doing? And do you feel necessary to cover these format wars and how they're pushing music in certain directions?
It's an interesting question because formats beget sonics. There are things, approaches that work better in a streaming format than they would have in an album, CD, vinyl format. I wrote a piece about Post Malone and Ray Shremmerd. because those records to me were just records that were designed to be streamed. They were designed to me. The dominant aesthetic strategy of those records was to make you forget that you could press stop. And that's not a thing. If you listen to records from the 90s, that's not you. You know where the song starts and middles and ends. It's very clear.
Yeah, there's a skip between them sometimes.
Yeah, but not. I think there are artists who are extremely well tuned to the delivery mechanisms. So in that way, I try to orient some of my writing around what is the mechanism, like how are people reacting to those mechanisms? We talk a lot on podcast about Spotify core, which is a thing I'm pretty sure we invented. If someone else invented it, please feel free to tell me. That, you know, I don't feel any ownership of it. But Spotify core being a particular type of pop music that's like innocuous, female singer, lightly European, BPM's a little faster than American pop, but not club fast, and that are absorptive kind of overall, in overall aesthetic. Like it's kind of like mushy a little bit. And if you look on the Spotify new music playlists, invariably you'll encounter 5 or 10 every week new songs of people you've just never heard of who are like maybe moderately popular in Sweden. And they have these songs and they all sound very structurally similar. I have not yet written a Spotify core take. Like I've not written that piece, but certainly we've talked about it a bunch on the podcast. And I think that it's, you can identify that that's an actual, innovation's a strong word because I don't know how innovative it is, but it's an actual sonic change that is happening. Part of my job as a critic is to decide, okay, that's happening. Is it important? Or literally, does it just serve to get from track 36 to track 38? Does it merely serve as kind of connective tissue? I'm not convinced I know the answer. I think it's probably not important in a big picture way, but it's certainly something I think about, especially as like Spotify core aesthetics eventually will trickle towards mainstream pop stars.
So this clip, I mean, I was just going back through your last year in publishing on the Times. A lot of stories.
Yeah.
I think I also caught that Kalefa Sena, who was previously a Times critic, got like a little burnt out on the pace. So
you really did the digging, yeah.
So sure. you're 10 years in.
Yeah.
Is it sustainable? Is this what you want to keep doing? Do you have other things that would work at different time paces?
I don't know. I think my skin is still young and dewy. So my hope is I can maintain a dewy disposition. No, it is my hope to begin work on a book very soon.
Mm.
Maybe as soon as when this podcast comes out,
and you know the topic for this.
I don't want to say it, but I do know what the topic is.
If you're a book editor,
y'all be seeing me.
Yeah.
I think what I'm trying to figure out is, are there things that I can say in a book that I can't say in my day-to-day job?
Yeah.
I also know that at some point, I'll just be 55 and I won't want to be in the studio with Juice WRLD. No shots to Juice WRLD.
Yeah.
Lovely experience.
Yeah.
But you know what I mean? Like, I just won't want that rhythmically. I'm a night person. I'm not a morning person. Like, I tend to be most productive between like 11 and 2 a.m. At a certain point, I'm sure it's like the realities of being an adult will like come in. But I've done a pretty good job of like kind of holding
gotten pretty far.
I've done well holding those at bay.
Do you get a different response in the studio now at however old you are now versus when you were in your 20s and you'd be in the studio with someone?
Yeah, in a way, you become more anonymous the older you are.
Yeah.
And you're like, you're just the old guy.
Yeah.
Even though I'm not that old, but you're not the kid. Like when I was 24 going in a studio, like I could reasonably be in someone's entourage, you know, like I could have been like that seventh guy in someone's entourage because I dressed the same and I still kind of dress the same. Like, you know, like I still, you know, Juice WRLD and I talked about the same, the sneakers I was wearing, which are like sneakers that he had been wearing at some other time in that week. You know, it's like, that's like, there's a visual language and there's a visual comfort. But as you get older, I think you become a little bit more anonymous. Like you become a little bit like, oh, that guy's here. But like, we're not thinking about it so much. But as a journalist, that's actually kind of good. That said, when I'm in my mid 50s or late 50s, like, you know, there but for the grace of go I. Like, I hope that's not what my life looks like. So, you know, a book, TV things. I have like a couple of things that are sort of halfway towards completion or halfway towards maybe getting a check somewhere. We'll see. But I'm lucky. I feel ending on like a positive note is so cheesy, but like I do.
You're a survivor.
I do genuinely feel like a lot of the writers that I grew up loving.
Yeah.
No longer write about music.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of my peers that I grew up with no longer write about music. I feel like incredibly, incredibly fortunate.
Thank you so much for this interview.
Appreciate you, man.
Thank you for listening to the Long Form Podcast. Thanks to my guest, John Caramonica. Thanks to my co-hosts, Evan Ratliff and Max Linsky. Thanks to our editor this week, Janelle Pfeiffer. Thanks to our intern, Tyler McCloskey. Thanks to Google Play. Thanks to Read This Summer, which is put on by MailChimp. And we really appreciate them for everything they do for the show. And of course, thanks to the writing department at the University of Pittsburgh. If you want to get in touch, you can send us an email, podcast@longform.org. We'll be back next week.